this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, please press star one to ask your question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I will turn the call over to Mr. Howard Wechsler. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Howard Wechsler, Division Director for Information and Intelligence Systems and the SIS Director at NSF. It is indeed a very special pleasure for me today to be able to introduce our guest, Deborah Estrin. Debbie has repeatedly demonstrated herself as a pioneer in our discipline. She's a pioneer in the area of embedded sensors and led to the awarding of the NSF Science and Technology Center for embedded network sensing.
You might say not be on.
Okay, I guess I'm not on. Okay. She's, of course, also pioneered in the area of what we call, what we lovingly call smart health, having engaged in the area of distributed sensors for gathering physiological and behavioral data on a continuous basis, and she'll be telling us a bit more about that today. So check off area two in which she's a pioneer in smart health. And area three, not to leave educational goals out, I think she was the first external hire at the new Cornell New York Tech Center. All right? So we're pleased to see that she's made that move to the east, and therefore she'll be able to come visit us at NSF and our panels and whatnot much more often. So noting not just what I note, but others have noted her successes as well. In 2003, she received Popular Science named her one of the Brilliant 10 that year. So it's always nice when we get into the public, the broad press, and they recognize what we're doing. And in 2007, she received the Anita Borg Institute Women of Vision Award for Innovation. So she certainly has placed herself well in our discipline, had many accomplishments, and today she's going to tell us about some of her newest work.
Thank you very much. So people sometimes make fun of me for the amount of affection I have for NSF, and I hope by now people understand I'm not pandering. But it started early on when I was in graduate school. My mother came here for a stint professionally, and it really was transformative for her. It makes me choke up because she's many years into dementia, and she doesn't remember that she was here. But the poster that everyone gave her when she left is still up on her wall of a sort of caricature of my mother with her running shoes on with her suit, and it was a really special time after having been somebody who was a woman on soft money for so many years. And it was really a place that recognized her potential. That popular science thing really in some ways happened because of NSF, in the sense that NSF and the opportunity to even think about something like an STC caused me to think broadly, to sort of, I'm a technologist, I'm an engineer, I'm sometimes just pathologically pragmatic. So I don't really, you know, have a rich fantasy life, right? If there's not a chance that something can actually materialize, it doesn't draw me in. And being able to think about an STC and what it would take, what was worth that investment on the part of the government, the NSF, our tax dollars, and the effort of people to come together and work together was to sort of have a much broader vision as a technologist. And that does speak to the broader community. And so just really want to applaud. In between those, of course, there was NSFNet, right? And everything that has been, there's a conversation going on the internet among some of the old boys network on the internet that includes some girls. And that whole transformative thing that made the internet really be allowed to go commercial, but with analytics and so much of that, the role that NSF had. So thank you for having me here. It means a lot to me. So I want to talk to you about some newer work on what I've started calling small data. But I'll spend a lot of time talking about the work that led up to that and is in the context of small data, but I really see this as sort of a next new broadening, as I'll say more. So I'll talk about work I've been doing in the context of mobile health that has a lot of overlap with the smart health programs here, and looking at it as this N equals me data. So it's a play on words, a play on terms, where usually we're looking for large studies with large N for very good reasons, because if you only have small N, you don't know how it's going to generalize, and you haven't accommodated for that. But there's something really interesting that has emerged as an opportunity around individuals being able to have a better understanding of themselves over time, and clinicians having a better understanding of them over time. And as I'll say at the end, maybe, you know, teachers having a better understanding of their students over time, and students of themselves or consumers of themselves. And really, it's a little bit of a broadening of some of these rather edgy, sometimes odd movements that we look at, like quantified self, brought together with a sort of a do-it-yourself mentality and a maker community, that people can be the source of data and insight around themselves, and also in the context of all that's been going on around behavioral economics and behavioral psychology. There's really sort of a coming together of why this is a very rich time for looking at N equals me data, not in the narcissistic sense, but in a productive sense that I'll talk about. So mobile health is, and this is an old sort of diagram of what I mean by it, is the notion, and it's by no means just me, is that taking a tagline that we started using at SENS when we were talking about wireless sensing from the very beginning, which was the whole notion of why was wireless sensing something new? Why was embedding sensing in the environment something new? Because you were turning things that were previously unmeasurable. You were making visible the previously invisible. You're making measurable the previously unmeasured. And really what's different about mobile health, and in the broader sense, small data, is we're taking previously unmeasured or at least unrecorded behaviors and practices, and through processing and analysis and mashing up and providing context, turning that into personalized, evidence-based, and evidence-producing care. And that over time, this will both help individuals take care of themselves in a better way, in a more scientific manner way, help clinicians do better personalized care, and over time contribute to the research evidence base. So let me make it concrete. You have chronic back pain from an injury, whatever it is, and you are prescribed chronic pain medication. And chronic pain medication says, take as needed. And you can try to take an anti-inflammatory as a lesser approach. You could try, not under doctor's guidance, but under guidance of the web or your friends, some alternative approaches. I found one way in which I am truly a Californian, even though everyone has always thought I'm from New York. Growing up in California, I am a Californian when it comes to a broader notion of health and wellness. You might try a number of things yourself, right, that friends or people on the web have recommended. And that question of what is working for you is a very hard thing to actually track, because nothing is probably going to eliminate the source of your back pain. So it's not about a bee sting or a headache that might completely disappear with an aspirin. It's going to be subtle improvements. It can be exacerbated by things that you do, heavy exertion, sleeping on travel without the standard bed or pillow. You have lots of things can exacerbate it, stress and other things. And so it's very difficult to do that scientific controlled experiment on yourself. How little of the chronic pain medication that is opiate-based can I take? When can I get by with the other? It's an optimization problem. You don't want to under-consume medication, because you become too sedentary and it has all kinds of other health-related and behavior-related problems, and you don't want to overconsume because these things have addictive properties. And so the take-as-needed question and how do we balance our lives is one that now, because we live our lives digitally, there are ways in which that could now be informed with real systematic evidence for you as an individual. The same comes in even more broadly in the way individuals do clinical care. So my co-founder of Open Health, something I'll mention more later, my co-founder is Dr. Ida Sim from UCSF, MD, as well as a PhD in bioinformatics. And when she is treating a patient, she has lab reports as they come in, and she knows whether the set of medications they're on is helping their condition. But a fair amount, as we all know, is through a history that you give, that where you're reporting on your symptoms and your side effects. And that is a balancing that has been underserved with concrete, objective, and temporally high-resolution data. And then finally, there are a whole bunch of things that you could go ask your clinician and ask them, if I do X, will it help me with Y? And their correct answer is, there's no evidence to support that. Now, the answer, there is no evidence to support that, is absolutely factually true and means just that. There is no evidence to support it. It doesn't mean no. And the opportunity now to really understand a lot more from people's behavior and activities in the wild, from what we eat and drink to what supplements we buy or actually take, you know, from the aisle of Whole Foods, lots of things just aren't known because we don't have detailed data on people in the wild unless it comes up in the context of some clinical study. And now we're starting to see some of this in the big data web mining and some of the opportunities there to go and be able to dig down and try to understand correlations between things. But this N equals me data is taking advantage that we live digitally and we can have data feeding into these three feedback loops of health, if you will. And so you can think of it as a kind of a third pillar of personalized precision medicine. Obviously, a tremendous amount around big data, mining EHRs and web mining and all sorts of things, where the more that this big aggregate of population scale data is out there, we will be able to both discover as well as prove hypothesized correlation and causality. And of course, all the omics that are so driven off of computational support. And I would offer, and I'm not going to argue whether they're all the same height or girth of pillars, but another component there is the opportunity to actually have that phenotypical and behavioral information from individuals. So I'm going to talk about lots of examples and lots of things. I think examples help for you to have in mind. They help for me to sort of focus my narrative, but also in a constructive way, sort of to focus your skepticism in the sense that what am I talking about at a high level more concretely. So have in mind things like independent living transition. So independent living happens twice in our lives, right? It happens as we age. It also happens as, you know, our kids, as we leave the home. And in both of those, there are times and contexts where a complete now inability to have a sense of how somebody is. We no longer live in a village. We, relative to evolution, we travel much farther, right, from home base than we did in generations before. And so how can technology play a role in filling some of that gap? Autoimmune and inflammatory diseases have fluctuations to them. When you have a chronic back pain, while it has small fluctuations, the condition is basically there. You can make it much worse, but it doesn't have inherent fluctuations. Autoimmune inflammatory diseases do. Rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's, MS, they have flares that occur some small number of times a year, and you're trying to reduce their frequency and reduce their severity. And so having a technology and approach, is this horrible acoustics only one that I'm hearing, or you're hearing it too?
Yeah, a little bit.
You guys can hear me without this, right? Cool. Why were you being so polite? John, I understand why everyone else is being polite, but why were you being polite? They can hear me through a different microphone. Okay. So when we have an opportunity to see continuous data from people, from their functional behavior, as I'll say more, things in autoimmune and inflammatory disease have a lot, they're so undersampled now. Versus something that takes more just sort of step functions. And when you go into a clinical visit, you're sort of sampling it at an appropriate frequency. But autoimmune, very undersampled. Chronic pain, I mentioned, because of how much is on the sort of burden of the individual to do their own optimization. And right now, there is no blood test for perceived pain. So you can have the same physiological, anatomical condition, and you can't determine, other than empirically and from the person, how much medication is going to help them continue to function in their everyday life. And so, yes, at some point, fMRIs and everything will uncover the secret of that as well, but it's quite a way off. Mental health. So depression and how people are treated and prescribed for depression. It's there are many possible starting points for a clinician. They start with one that's always that is approved, right? But there are many possible starting points, as many antidepressants have, and then there's combinations of depression and anxiety. And you start off with somebody, you start off at a conservative dose, and it, none of these things kick in instantly. So the delay in the system, which isn't exactly known, it's not 48 hours, it's not 6 months, right? It's weeks to months, and you have to wait for that to happen to see whether, in fact, you're now treating at an effective dose, or whether, in fact, you want to increase the dose, or maybe there are some side effects that are going to cause you even to come down more. And during this sampling time, it's a really hard experimental domain because lots of things are happening in someone's life that can also shift their baseline of how they would self-report and come in 2 months later and say, is this an effective dose? Particularly good things could be happening in their life that change their sort of level set or particularly not. So the opportunity to be much more continuously with somebody and understand and provide better, more continuous data is huge in that space. And lastly, sort of different and from a research perspective, but just something, a collaboration I'm starting to really enjoy in New York City, is working with folks on the omics side who are really moving towards increasingly about longitudinal data about what's going on in terms of RNA transcription and metabolomics and all sorts of things that aren't just the full genome. It's how your genes are expressing and how looking at that can give them insight into disease mechanisms. And a lot of these things that aren't well understood, such as the inflammatory and autoimmune, rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's, and these sorts of things. And when they're collecting much more frequent blood data to do that, they also need the data around your symptoms and side effects, and they'd like to almost eventually be able to do a kind of adaptive sampling where when you're actually starting towards a flare, they have much more frequent biological data than when you're basically in steady state. So there's a nice connection between those two. Now, beyond health, there's really a lot of ways in life more generally that I think we'll see the opportunity for some of these same small N equals me data to play in. So preventative financial health, okay? What if when you went to make a significant purchase, you can have a setting on your email that lets you have it delayed by a couple minutes before it actually gets sent. All those emails we wish we could have retracted when we sent them out in some context. So financial health, if there's a small delay while the credit card is running and checking your credit, right, if you could see how that fits into your model and what it's going to do to your credit rating in some visceral way of connecting the immediate behavior to the longer-term behavior. As an example, scientific citizens, I like to play with the word, citizen science. And a lot of what we've tried to do in STEM through Mobilize project with Los Angeles School District and other contexts was trying to bring participatory sensing and teaching of statistics to students in their everyday lives so that they could think and use data in their everyday lives. And this is a way in which to think about the quantified self movement more broadly, the quantified student. So if students can start to engage in what made them successful on that particular unit, what was it that they were doing successfully to reinforce that success, to try to create it again? What aspect of trying to review or discussing with others fits their particular learning style? And it's a combination of both understanding their learning and helping to reinforce good behaviors. Family applications and even things like personal profiles. Right. So whether on a dating website, how you project yourself, rather letting your data speak for you, right, in a more authentic way, you call yourself an active person, right, and some kind of profile of where you actually things that are quite personal, right, what's your distribution of things you spend your discretionary income on, right? Those are the sorts of profiles. Or gaming, in terms of your avatar, your entity in a game might actually feed off of behaviors you want to encourage in the real world. So in the context of health, and I think that this can apply in other cases, it really can have some profound potential to rephrase this data about ourselves, can rephrase things like, does it work or what works better than other things? And so if you just look at that in a medical context where the standard of creating evidence is to expose a collection of individuals with the right statistical properties to an exposure and look at the strength of the association with the outcome, and we do these randomized control trials, which we need to keep doing, I'm not talking against RCTs, right, in which we randomize, for example, individuals to one medication versus another, the over-the-counter antacid versus a new pharma-based one, one antidepressant to another, et cetera, and we look at what works better. And this is a slide I borrow from my colleague, Ida Sim, as I said, a real doctor. And when she describes this, as she explains, it doesn't, when she sees results that show that one medication is more effective in 75% of the population, it doesn't actually really tell her what to do for the person sitting in front of her. Now, if you're talking about different chemotherapies and surgeries and things that are really not reversible, that's a much harder situation. But there are many things that we are prescribed and that we do that are actually something we're going to, medication we're supposed to take for a long time. High blood pressure medication doesn't cure high blood pressure. Once you're on it, you're supposed to be on it forever, but at what dose and in what as newer drugs emerge, switching over. And so being able to put somebody on a medication, measure their symptoms and side effects, go through a washout period, switch them over to the other, and identify which is better for them. That there now, because we have data down at the individual level virtually for free, because we all carry instruments around with us that are programmable, this sort of opportunity for changing the way we understand outcomes and treat people is a potential. And this can be true around learning styles as well. So what are these data? Let me just dig down a little bit to be a little bit more concrete. One very rich source of these data are just passively recorded activity and location traces from your phone. And these things, with or without a Fitbit and lots of nice, cool consumer devices that people buy and which are good in some ways for other reasons, because they remind you like a string around your wrist in that kind of very visceral sense. But a lot of that you can just run on your in the background on your phone. Android users have been able to for a long time, and now the new iPhone architecture will let the iPhone do it as well. When you have a continuous activity location trace, there is a tremendous amount you can infer about an individual. And Ginger.io is a really nice example of a startup company that has leveraged this startup out of MIT originally. And what Ginger.io does, for example, in one of their contexts in which it's used, is they're looking at major depressive disorder and diabetes. So diabetics who are depressed have significant problems with adherence. Non-adherence can lead to very very severe side effects, as your lack of management of your blood glucose has implications on your body and on your other organs. And so identifying those patients that are at risk for really going way out of adherence and coming in with some support and help is very important in diabetes management. And so what they do is, if you run Ginger on your phone, it captures some aspect of your activity through the accelerometer and your location by sampling that intermittently, as well as statistics from your communication. It establishes a baseline for you, and it looks for variation from that. So they have a very rich machine learning engine in the back that is building good models because they have lots of individuals in their system, but it's also building individualized models for you as you subscribe. And so in a number of contexts, they're looking at working alongside clinical systems to help do broader population management and focus early interventions for people who whose non-adherence to prescription will really end up having severe medical consequences for them. Mobile apps also generate data. So there are lots of mobile apps out there, and they some of them are directly health-related, but more generally, the apps we use and when we use them are also sources of data. They're sources of information. So when you play your games with friends or Angry Birds, right, there's both that when is it that you take those breaks, and there can also be, you know, what? How do you do, right? What is that vocabulary score on how you do when you're using words with friends under different conditions? How can that serve you as an individual sort of looking at how your cognitive performance, whether because it's with or without caffeine, poor or good sleep, stressed or not, how can that feed in to be part of your personal analytics? And yes, of course, there are real sensors too. So there are particular devices designed to measure particular physiological parameters, some of them quite directly medical related, whether it's pulse ox or blood glucose, some of them more consumer-related, some of them combined consumer-related devices like Body Media, a really early important player recently purchased by Jawbone, whether it's the range of at-home wireless devices that you might connect in through your Qualcomm TuneNet hub that's doing a number of different different measurements, perhaps for people recently released from the hospital. So, yes, these real sensor streams are important, but I don't think they're more important than all those other streams that tell you about basic function. So, and it's not just about one data stream. To describe you and how you're responding and how you're doing, where you are in your disease state, is a more complex story than any one of those dimensions. And so one of the a quick pointer and plug for Open M Health, which is a nonprofit startup with seed funding from Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, is to create an open modular ecosystem, because you don't want to have to go and download every app individually. Well, that's okay. But in the end, to bring a clinical picture, even a summary to you or perhaps your informal caregiver loved one, let alone to your clinician, these things are going to have to come together in some coherent way that's easy to see. You're not going to, you might walk in with a bunch of links to a bunch of different windows that you might want your clinician to open up and look at, but that's going to be a non-starter, right? There's no time in the clinical system for that. So we've been exploring and working with the community to really take these disparate sources of data by having a standardized architecture with standard APIs and encouraging the community to come together and focus not just on new sensor devices and new individual data streams, but on making sense of those data streams over time and in combination. And that's where a lot of the core challenges actually are, in really transforming these fused data streams into something that can be personalized and precise measures of a chronic disease. And to do that is not a simple matter of a pretty picture or an anecdote. It both although that's what I have here. It's not necessarily a pretty picture, but anecdotally, right, to make it concrete. I've been monitoring my, you know, activity and location for years, right, in the background. And you can see sort of interesting maps of where you're going. It might be a personal interest. There are comical, you know, they're sort of, it's another way of representing when you go and travel. When I climbed Mount Fuji and I got to the bottom, I was running one of these things, and instead of, I sent an email to my family with a geotrace on the map of us hiking up Mount Fuji. And the members of my family, even the nerdy members of my family who opened the mail, expected to see a photograph, right? But this was a different way of telling this story of what we've done. And so that's true, but it's very much, those are ways of sharing stories. You want to bring it into a clinical system. What is it about my location and activity patterns over time that are really going to be a clinical measure? So take rheumatoid arthritis. From that trace, the clinicians, the researchers and the clinicians don't want to see a continuous trace. They don't want to see, you know, my fuel count on my Nike Plus, or they don't want to see a number of steps. What they want to see is trending over time. what time of day for their patient, what time was the patient getting out of the house in the morning. Rheumatoid arthritis typically accompanied by morning stiffness, not particularly understood why, but there's that when you're more in a prodrome and when you're in a flare, it's hard to get out of the house in the morning, okay? Hours spent out of the house and minutes spent ambulatory, meaning just doing anything that's actually up and moving instead of sitting. Those are three derived measures from an activity location trace that are that they believe can be relevant to giving you the feedback about whether a course of treatment is being effective or whether somebody might be entering a flare and you'd rather intervene early because the longer you leave the flare untreated, the more steroids and things they have to take to bring it back down. What's interesting about that story is that as I work with people who do Crohn's disease, for example, or IBS, some related symptoms but very different physiologically, they clinically ask their patients the same thing. When do you get out of the house in the morning and how much time do you spend out of the house is a measure of the person's sense of safety that they're not going to have urgent needs, and it, which causes them to stay closer to home base when you have severe GI problems. And so these are the opportunity to take these same underlying measures but then convert them into things that are going to be robust markers for particular conditions, I think is where a lot of the interesting opportunities in a relatively near term actually lie. And then the same for depression, right? Some people spend a lot more time holed up when they're and isolating when they're depressed. Other people go and self-medicate. They're actually out there more in that partying mode. Many people, as their depression is more severe, have trouble behavioral activation of getting themselves up and out of the house. So again, you're going to want to pull different derived values out of this time location trace in addition to increasingly being able to use other sources of data to feed into that as well. So I like to use the term a behavioral biomarker. These are things, look, if you can take a blood sample and objectively and systematically and precisely derive where somebody is in their disease state, and they can do it with a finger prick in the way that that people with diabetes do, we'll never beat that. But there are so many things that just we have no idea how to read in the blood. And we can't read it in the heart rate. And we can't read it in some of these other direct physiological measures, but we end up seeing it played out in people's behavior. And since our activities are so digitally based now, the opportunity to almost for free, once we figure out how to solve the problem, reapplying that algorithm, right, the incremental application of it is for free, is a really a significant scalable opportunity. And so, again, some of the context in which this has more applicability. And so when we go to do that, we're sort of at pretty young times in terms of figuring out what is this hierarchy of analysis that with lots of commonality down at the bottom, these are just examples that lead to the right kind of summarization. And as you move up the stack, you move to things that are more and more domain specific. But there's a lot of commonality in the overall. It's a similar to the way you think about speech or vision or what have you. In all these other fields, you use some common underlying constructs to do your analysis, and then you start to do object or motion detection, and then you start to do things very differently if what you're trying to do is, you know, some kind of robotic on the assembly line versus a surveillance camera. Right. So as we move up, we get to things that are more application specific, but there's a lot of shared underlying approaches. And I think that's where the field is now, is the opportunity of creating what will hopefully be modular and reusable techniques for this. And it's a good time to mention the whole issue of too much information, which plays both ways. Okay. So that expression of too much information, people often use as the recipient, like, I really don't need to hear all that detail. And from a clinician's perspective, it simply isn't actionable, and they feel liable to actually listen to what you're saying, what information you tell them they are supposed to use. And when it's too much and it can't actually be fit into whatever amount of time they actually end up having with you, it adds more noise to clarity. So we have to come up with these higher level summaries of what's going on and figure out what is a marker for rheumatoid arthritis, what is a good piece of data to use for a person who's being whose drugs are being titrated for depression or lupus or whatever that condition might be. And at the same time, there are all kinds of notions also on the consumer side. That's just too much information to share. And that can be, sometimes people feel that way about their clinicians. Many people don't have a relationship with a clinician. They deal with a clinical system. And in employer-based or otherwise, that can feel like that's scary information to share with people in terms of where is my every moment's location. And I think in this way, both usability by the clinical system and privacy on the part of the consumer are actually well aligned as opposed to at odds with one another. So through this process of reduction of information, but increasingly useful information, you get to a kind of selective sharing that hopefully has a high information content for the clinician. Okay, so I've largely been using examples from mobile, and that's where it really is a sweet spot place to be able to have a person capture analytics about themselves. A lot of our communication is mediated this way. It's usually with us as we're out and about. It might or might not be how we make purchases. It is often what we do to entertain ourselves in between and at moments of short moments of downtime, and increasingly how people are consuming different kinds of entertainment. At the same time, the things that we do that aren't mediated by this. And so just to tell you a story, which is true how I got to this. I was on sabbatical at the end of last year, and I received an email from a woman, didn't know, haven't met her, I've exchanged email with her only, named Gert, living in Berkeley. And she'd read an article in which I was quoted on some mobile health work in the New York Times. And she wrote me and said, you know, it was really interesting, but I'm 70, and my friends and I, we all have phones, we have cell phones, but we're mostly on the internet, we're not on Facebook. And I lost my partner about a year ago, and I have a sense that if I'd had some way of sort of keeping tabs on him, and in some way if I sort of my friends could sort of keep tabs on me, and she described it in our exchange as sort of an eight bells and all is well, right? There's some way that she could just share with a small number of friends and family an eight bells and all is well. We started calling it in our exchange a well-being pulse. Actually called it a social pulse. It was a bad name for all kinds of reasons. So let's just think of it as a well-being pulse. And that actually overlapped with, did anyone actually listen to my TED talk? Okay, good. It's always embarrassing to tell the same joke twice. This isn't a joke. You'll see how horrible of an off-the-cuff remark that just was. But it's never fun to tell the same story twice. So the story I told in my TED Med talk was not about Gert, but it was at the time when I had this exchange with her, it really resonated with me because I had lost my father earlier in the year and had this very intense several months. I was at a meeting, actually, during when we had no idea what was going on. I was at some smart health meeting and saw Howard and Misha and was talking to them about having no idea what was going on. And this exchange with her had me thinking about what might I have understood earlier about my father's condition from his digital traces. And one of the first things I did notice, that we noticed, is that he stopped responding to email. Now, for a 90-year-old man, you might roll your eyes and say, you know, this is not so unusual, but my father, some of you might have known him, was on the original ARPANET, right, from the mid-70s. And he was not exactly a digital native, but a very habitual email user. It was very unusual for him. But in only that I noticed at the time. That was sort of my sign. Something is wrong, right? But there were other things that I only thought about in retrospect, because only in retrospect did I find out that he had stopped preparing food at home. My mother has dementia. He was her primary caregiver until his passing. And he would prepare a meal a few times a week. Simple, but he would. But he had stopped somehow, not as a step function, just gradually, stopped buying food at the market to prepare at home. All of their meals were really eaten out or the leftovers from the restaurant. Not something he thought of telling anybody. or that I thought of asking, but unraveled as being clear in retrospect. And his walks around the neighborhood, he was a very determined, habitual walker, got smaller and smaller and began to get less frequent. Again, in retrospect, it wasn't a step function. And so when I thought about what Gert was describing, I realized that my father, having a kind of a well-being pulse, would have taken as input his loyalty card at the supermarket, right, his data stream coming back from the supermarket, his location trace, which could come from this and actually conceptually could come from AT&T or Verizon or whoever your carrier is, and his email pattern trace. And no one, it's not diagnostic to say you're this way or you're that way, depending on how these things look. It'll be a long time before we have that much going on in models like that. But for relative to your baseline, relative to what eight bells and all is well for you, noticing that something's in decline. And so this isn't that had I known that, he would not have passed. It was his time. But even when we, his cardiologist didn't know what was going on until the very end, none of it showed up on a DKG. And even in an emergency room visit, I think 2 weeks before he passed away, the attending doctor had no information that could tell him. The man just looked like a 90-year-old man. And the attending doctor looked at me like, what are you doing taking place in the emergency room? There are people here who have been shot or have been in car accidents, and you have a 90-year-old father. Why are you wasting our time? I had no way of really objectively expressing to him that this 90-year-old was behaving entirely differently 4 weeks ago, and he was still 90, right? And so it's not that it's necessarily about life or death, but that management, having us to have the tools to communicate with the clinical team, even having the tools for my father to know himself what was happening, are things that are important in people's lives. So that got me thinking, whatever nerd technologist that I am, about small data. And use the term small data because everyone's talking about big data, as they should be. I'm not trying to say it's about small data dummies. Big data is super important. But small data is also really powerful. And you can think about small data as being basically your row of their matrix. Right, big enterprise for all their customers and users, right, for each one of them, and then they do big things over that, right? It's your row. It's your trace from your cellular carrier. It's your loyalty card trace from your supermarket and so forth. So mobile carriers, your cable box. In talking to a vice president, actually, at Time Warner, who does a lot of the cable TV facilities in New York City. She was saying, as I was trying to suggest that we collaborate on a small data testbed in New York City, which I'm trying to build, she said, I might be able to finally show my father-in-law that he really is losing his hearing just by looking at the digital trace of the volume control, right, that it is different than it was 6 months ago. He doesn't notice it because it's day-to-day and hour-to-hour, but I can see it on the weeks or months, every month that I visit him. They're all, and none of these are a killer app, but it's just in combination the opportunities that whether you like it or not, these digital data are there. If it bothers you, again, that my pathologically pragmatic side comes out, that's probably too late in terms of whether there is tremendous digital evidence and digital traces about each of us out there in the real world. As long as they're out there, can we get to them to use them in ways that are for us as well? Not to the exclusion of them being used for all sorts of big data analytics, but in addition. Smart meters, from the early days of smart meters, people have talked about privacy and smart meters. And privacy is one angle of what does my smart meter tell about me? Well, if your smart meter, wherever there's a privacy concern in big data, there's an opportunity. Because if it's telling something about you, maybe it can tell something about you to you, or in some useful sort of a way. And so really, the reduction in my father's cooking habits would have shown up in his smart meter signal as well. E-commerce, it's one of the ones that I've made least progress on so far, but I'm quite determined in terms of, I think the thing that we have most important for so many aspects of health, both from understanding the science as well as its intervention, has to do with the food we eat. And it is so hard to measure. None of the approaches of journaling or taking pictures or any of those things are really sustainable by normal people. And maybe we'll be able to get a little bit of a handle on it if we can start to get people's traces of transactions in purchasing of food. And lots of other things from search, right, what it tells about our state of mind, social media and email, just wonderful opportunities for NLP over all the ways and places we use language. So through our texting and our emails and even our speech, which is increasingly digital, the opportunity to find patterns of speech use that can be our own personal indicators. Smart cars, I don't think about that anymore because I don't have one and I'm no longer in Los Angeles. I don't even get in taxis anymore if I don't have to. And games and music and entertainment. So as I was saying, it's not just about health. It goes from health to well-being to consumption to family logistics. Can this be part of something that helps people create new habits around the family meal or shifts in the overall carb load in the family food budget, right? You could have an app that computes your carbon load in your weekly food consumption budget. Right? Carb in terms of moving away from carbs, carbon in terms of how far did the food travel to, you know, something that could appeal to the both the, you know, I just thought of this, it's a horrible pun. My father would roll his eyes, right? To appeal to both the greener and the leaner, you know, side of you, right? And that's an important part of this whole vision because the idea here is that we are not, most of us, quantified selfers and are never going to be. We're too busy. Let's just leave it at that. Okay, and that's not where we focus. Just like most of us are not performance athletes, right? There are all these interesting behaviors we see out there, but for the most part, that's not who we are. And so we're not going to get back our data and write some R code that goes and processes that or Python code or whatever it is to process our data and study it. But we can create a new ecosystem of applications that run over it. So the model is that if I can get access to my data and really be the nexus of my data streams so that I can, when I subscribe and set up all those different things, when you do your billing for your new cellular carrier, you can opt in. They have an API to your carrier, and you can have your estimated activity location stream coming back from your mobile carrier to your, wherever it is, your personal data bank that just as we make different decisions as consumers as to where we put our money, could be in a credit union, could be in a commercial service. And there would be an ecosystem of apps that run over it to make it interesting. So just as with PHRs, right, when you try to establish a PHR, a personal health record, if you don't have apps that make that somehow interesting to the individual, it just hasn't gotten started. You need the data to automatically feed it. You can't have people entering things by hand. And you need the way in which those data are made meaningful to an individual, made meaningful because they're fun in some form of an entertainment, or made meaningful because it helps them achieve better health. So part of this is the data liberation story. Todd Park really started that term and the whole open data initiative and health data palooza and his notion about liberating data, get data out there so that people and communities and companies can use it. It's the same thing here, right? Let individuals get access to their data in a programmatic, real-time, opt-in way. You're not releasing their personal data to someone else. You're not violating the Cable Act, which says if you're a cable operator, you can't use that data for other things. Google can, cable operator cannot. Right? But because all you're doing is giving that data back to the individual. It's like giving them their billing data. And you're not violating the Common Carriage Act. You can be a carrier. You're not using that data for somebody else. You don't have to anonymize it. The whole point is it's not anonymized. It's about you, and along with the other data about you, apps would consume to both in fun and useful ways support you. So I'm excited about this space because I think it can fuel a kind of a new market of third-party apps and services, and also in a way that shifts a little bit some of our conversation about privacy. And that the value of actually seeing what is known about you is a step in the direction of some balance in this conversation about privacy. I think what is disturbing to many people is to have things known that they don't know. And when you know what is known, not through because you can go and, you know, submit a FOIA, right, Freedom of Information Act submission, but because what is known about you is informing your own apps, it just creates both, it's a utility in the apps that those things would give you, that the apps would give you, and it's a balance even as we come to talk about some of the issues around privacy, which obviously PRISM and other things have brought even more to light. This isn't easy, so we have to get the data. Actually getting those personal data APIs opened up has a lot to do with incentivizing the service providers and having them not feel afraid to do it. And I've actually, so I have, not that I have full corporate commitment, but I have a little informal collaborative forming, and I had a meeting with AT&T and Verizon and Time Warner and Ericsson and Intel and IBM, and really with quite an interest in exploring this kind of a space because there are revenue models out there down the line as well. American Express was there as well. So even some of these companies that are coming in as loyalty cards and mobile money providers, there are value added that I think we can address that incentivizing incentivizing issue. The technical challenges are all in making sense of the data, but dealing with how noisy and biased and diverse these things are. And lots of opportunities from the lower level, if you will, components of signal processing and machine learning and natural language processing to the bigger model development of the individual. And on this, these questions around privacy and data access and accountability and actually building systems that we would trust to be such potentially honeypots for important data and understanding of ourselves. And since from my early days as an internet protocol person, I think it's clear that the way we do things best when it comes to applied computer science and information technologies is by really taking that. We did it first in those contexts, you know, the whole notion of a minimal viable product and getting out to the field early and doing a lot of experimentation and pilots and prototyping to see where this can really take us. So one of the things I'm doing is, as I just mentioned a moment ago, working on creating a research infrastructure in New York City, which would be a test bed for small data that we could use, but that as New York City is an interesting test bed for marketers and all sorts of things all over the world, it's an interesting opportunity to build a test bed of this kind where we could easily recruit people into all kinds of different pilots. Their personal data would come into their personal data vault. We would develop apps and services and processing elements and machine learning tools that let us actually start to realize this vision of making use of small data. So I just want to end with the couple minutes I have just to mention Cornell Tech, which was mentioned at the beginning. It's not in Ithaca. It's in Manhattan. It will ultimately, it's Bloomberg's administration's vision of creating a new tech campus, a new basis, additional basis for the economy in New York City. It will eventually be on Roosevelt Island. We'll move there in around 4 years, and in the meantime, we have very generously been given rent-free space in the building that Google owns. We are not inside Google, but we are one of their tenants who doesn't pay rent in their building. And what's so exciting about the campus that is above and beyond it being in a very exciting in a very exciting city, it's about a campus that really embraces and embeds external engagement. So whether that's work with startups or with larger companies, whether it's work with nonprofits, it's really attracting people who want to spend a lot of their time applying. So they do applied work, or they do more theoretical work, but part of what drives their intellectual energy and their activities is spending time applying their work, which gives you a really strong basis for actually engaging with the media and health and medicine and built environment and education and nonprofit sector and foundation sectors that are there in the city. And so it explicitly has a notion of research hubs, the initial ones being around healthier life, built environments, and connected media. And we are actively recruiting our next round. We started up in January with a beta class, and we have our first sort of full class on our first of 8 master's programs. Master's students are the first class citizens, fewer PhD students are very important to us, but they'll always be sort of smaller in number. We won't have full-time undergraduate degree programs. And so we're really trying to design this to be and to create a new kind of master's student, computer science, information sciences, computer engineering, and operations research business. There are two-year programs that will give you time to learn a vertical, if you will, a hub domain as well. So wanted to be sure to get that advertisement out there. And more about all of this is up on the web.
Okay, thank you very much. So, question.
Oh, you can't do that to me. I'll really be depressed.
So what's going to happen if I say yes to this?
Good question. We are just building accounts in that sense, right? Because some of this involves going to these service providers and saying, yeah, there are really people out there who are interested in this. And going to app developers, apps that won't necessarily run here, they'll run in like your virtual container in the cloud, right? App developers say, there are really people interested in this. So it's a little bit of that when there's a street artist and they want to start to build a crowd, you have to start by getting the people around to start clapping their hands, which builds a crowd, and then they start their performance. Just a little bit of that, of gauging interest. And we will be, and we'll build our mailing list to be in touch with you about possibly engaging in early pilots and things like that.
I don't know if anybody saw the NOVA program yesterday, the Brain on Trial.
No.
And it was quite fascinating, where they're actually trying to understand the brain using fMRI. And
While
I was listening to you, The reason why they try to understand the brain is to understand the behavior. Okay. And what role the brain, in particular the maturing brain, plays in the observable behavior.
Yes.
And I think that we cannot stick everybody in an MRI tube three times a year or whatever. There was one researcher who was sticking his two kids in the fMRI since they were 3 years old, a couple of times a year.
Okay. Oh, that's intense.
But I think in your approach, where you're actually collecting data about the observable behavior, if somebody may be connected to all the other stuff, but I think this is
Is anyone here from SB? Is anyone here from SB? Yeah. There must be a good reason why you're not doing this, but it has always seemed to me as first it was with mobile and certainly in small data, right? There's finally an MREFC for SBE in this somehow.
I think there's a huge role in there that
you barely But we need to go and start doing it. Yeah. And we should do it in a way that's relatively open and modular so that we can have that role we play. And I just think there's a great I never thought after NEON I would mention MREFC letters again, but yes.
Yeah. So how far away are we from actually seeing personalized data informing information for healthcare at a personalized level?
You know, so I think, it depends what means. I was talking with a company I won't mention. They'll make an announcement, fairly soon, right, that I think the next wave of PHRs that has more of the underlying pieces actually automatically injected with information and with the notion of apps or something that make it useful to the person, so both sides of what's needed to make the thing basically useful, that will start to inform it. So I think it is actually going to start to happen in that first wave. How long it will take to ripple through, right? But that's not around all the omics stuff, right? The omics discoveries are a little bit more like in my previous life, like the transducers, the basic underlying sensor technology was. They have it's a different time scale. It's an unbelievably hard problem, and it will just take lots of time for those things to emerge and last. So the really detailed actually knowing what our systems do and really be able to, in a precise way, then be able to do precision medicine for it, that's something we'll benefit incrementally as it goes. But the PHR side of it, I don't know. I'm more optimistic than I was a couple years ago.
May I add something?
Yeah.
So we've heard a lot about being able to predict decline, but the way it's used now quite robustly is post-operatively.
Yeah.
People leave the hospital often with various kinds of devices attached to them, and the monitoring of their activities and their behavior is extremely important in determining how well they are healing.
Yep.
So it's in place now, and actually the new laws with respect to the health systems having, or the hospitals having paid the cost of people who are returning will provide greater impetus.
Yes.
For more of those systems and more attention to what that data says, so they can know, they can stop and intervene before a person comes back to the hospital.
It's a really good point, because one of the hard things here is if you're just going to be monitoring everything forever and you're waiting to see some subtle decline, that's going to be a long, hard problem. But here in the whole hospital readmission thing, it's a perfect time. You have that opportunity to clearly you want to monitor. You're going to have people improving at different rates. You'll learn more about how that gets determined, and you'll be able to detect that actually something's gone wrong. So it really is not only from a cost perspective important, it's also a really good place to start to mature this approach, and then it will trickle out.
Yes.
I wonder how the problem of informing third parties is going to appear here. Because, like, for example, your father,
you
would like to know, because it's not so important that he knows what's going on, because he might be not ask. It's not actionable for him.
Right.
But how can it be legally, you know, lots and lots of, and also how this information is going to get to you, there should be some.
Yes, and so I think that comes up even without anything that I've really talked about, just with respect to the PHRs, and it's a very good and important thing. And those are being set up now, at least I think this newer wave of them, with from the beginning this question of who do you give access to? You have your informal caregivers, and it might go from, in an assisted living context, more formal people in the caregiving chain, but it might be to your one of your children or a neighbor or things like that. So people are explicitly making sure that these personal health records have a place in an explicit moment in time and in which you decide who has access, who would get alerted. And some of these things are simply social choices that don't have anything to particularly do with medical, right? Gert wasn't talking about something that necessarily had anything to do with her hospital or her clinic. It was that if you can do all kinds of different Facebook apps, right, her version of her social network are these few people who she would like, they would like to have a kind of not imposing, but sort of tabs on one another. So the medical stuff, I think people are on it in terms of figuring that out. And I think some of these other things will come in through social media, particularly when we have more diversity in the underlying platforms of what makes for social media.
Let's take a question from the outside. Our telephone.
Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment. At this time, there are no questions on the phone line.
Okay, thank you. Anything, anywhere else? Yes.
Well, I was going to ask a question that deals with policy, right? So HIPAA regulates specific intentional medical records,
mm-hmm.
and this is an unintentional medical record, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a socialized role.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking about the policy implications of these unintentional medical records.
So some of them might not emerge as unintentional medical records. They might well emerge as a gateway for evidence in sort of everyday life to come in some processed way to the medical record, which is then being used for clinical purposes and is absolutely subject to HIPAA like anything else, just like the doctor would enter things from your clinical history. So when a doctor in the waiting room, you enter things on your history, right? So just that, I think, is treated in the same way. Things that are really pre-clinical, the diary you keep, this kind of information, it's in the category of what the clinical side refers to as patient-reported information, which is associated with all kinds of questionable bias and robustness, and it's all true, right? When you have something that's offered in a not engineered, monitored, regulated setting, it will be noisier. And so it's, I think that until it is actually in the record, it's less about HIPAA, and it's more about it being, having it be used that way is more about establishing, doing lots of studies quickly right, to realize how to turn these noisy sources of data and under what conditions and with what kind of information. Can you trust them as a reliable source of information coming into the to the clinical care? So it's not that I think it means that because of association with medical, therefore everything has to be governed by HIPAA.
I was arguing yes. that other people who have great resources would use it as if it were medical data, but it's not covered by HIPAA. That was more of the tangle of my question.
So in the sense that the with all these systems that we interact with, because we buy things, we use cell phones, we right, those the system operators of various kinds have these data. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
So they, yes, in aggregate, can be asked to sell them as additional data that pharma or payers might want to buy.
And it's already happening.
But it's until things are in the context of. And yes, this doesn't speak anything about that, and it won't prevent it, nor will it explicitly add to it. I just, again, I think that it's in every context where there is a privacy concern, the more we know about them and the more we can also turn those data to our advantage is all I'm trying to bring into the picture. But you're right.
So if Google can give your email data away to the government,
mm-hmm.
give your health data.
When, or your email data with some good machine learning models and some
right.
processing can be indicative of your of
yeah.
your health. And so even though when you do the 23andMe, it might not actually be deterministic about whether, in fact, you're at risk of earlier stage Alzheimer's or dementia, maybe as we start to see it with the language patterns, right, those earlier indications are there. And then, right, those things are really relevant to not just employers. They're relevant to your colleagues, right? Who choose you as their co-founder and what have you. So, yes, I am I think I did this to you even, right, when you started talking about sharing our genomic information, and I shut you down. I did it once before to Eric Horvitz, in that I just think it's I'm not one much for polite company since I'm not particularly polite, wasn't particularly well-bred, but the notion of in a social setting putting people, other people in a spot to report on what did their 23andMe results tell about whether they had the genes for Alzheimer's, I just don't think it's the kind of thing that we should be putting people on the spot to tell those stories. So, yeah.
Okay, anything else? All right, let's thank our speaker again. Let's see your agenda.
I'm in Irwin's hands.
Let me introduce his wife.
Great.
How are you, man?
Good, and you?
I'm raised by wolves. I don't think I answered my question very well.
Okay.
I love your work.